You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is young adult novelist Laurie Hulse Anderson. Her 13 novels have sold millions of copies while tackling difficult adolescent themes with humor and sensitivity. Those themes include those of race, bullying, families coping with PTSD, eating disorders, and sexual assault. The latter subject was the focus of her acclaimed book Speak, released in 1999, which is now out in a new 20th anniversary edition. And that book brought Anderson into the national dialogue over rape culture and consent, a role she has been forthright with in conversations with young people ever since, telling them that Melinda, the 14-year-old girl who was raped in the book, was based on her own story. While she spoke of her own story to young people for many years, she's never written about it until now. Her new memoir, written in blank verse, is titled Shout. Our conversation today will include a frank discussion of sexuality and sexual assault. This could be triggering for you or upsetting. I encourage you to tune in next time. Laurie Hulse Anderson is my guest today. Laurie Hulse Anderson, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
This latest book came about, interestingly, at the 20th anniversary of one of your most important books, Speak. And as I understand it, this book came up together pretty quickly. You've been telling your personal story to audiences for many years, probably since Speak came out. What was there a catalyst for deciding to write your own story, and especially doing it in free verse, as you did?
Well, I've been writing poetry since I could hold a pencil. My father was a poet, and I was exposed to a lot of great poetry as a child. So it's not really surprising to me, although it might be to my readers, that this book came out in poems. And it really, this book came together quickly because as the Me Too movement was elevated a little bit by some Hollywood women in 2017, let's pause here for a moment and always point out that the Me Too movement was begun by Tarana Burke in 2006. And she really deserves the credit for getting that ball rolling, and she's continuing that important work. But in 2017, a number of women in Hollywood who had been abused and hurt elevated it to the national discussion. And there was a predictable and very frustrating backlash of misogyny and people doubting women who are survivors and just, things that I've heard often. And I don't know what it was. I was in New York City, so maybe I was in kind of a bad mood. But that backlash and some of the statements that were being made just set my brain on fire. And I've heard from so many thousands and thousands of survivors personally. And I know what sexual violence does to a person, male, female, or transgendered. And so this poetry about those experiences just started flowing out of me like a volcano exploding. And that's what the next few months of writing were like.
I was really struck by the very last poem in the collection, which you actually referred to some of these poems as rage poems.
Yeah.
And they certainly are. But there's some serious frustration being vented in some of these poems.
Yes, sir.
And of course, It gets back to the whole idea, here we're talking, reflecting on the Me Too movement. This is as old as humans have been around. These issues.
These issues, certainly. Yeah. And I think we have to remember, as we're all trying to mature as a culture in America, there are a lot of the foundational elements of American culture that have to do with dominance. We stole land. The European immigrants, when I say we, I am identifying as a child of European immigrants. We took land without permission. We held millions of families in slavery. We're kind of wedded to this idealistic version of people pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, and a lot of our sports are pretty violent. And you can look through that lens and see that it's a culture that rewards dominance. When really, if we want to be a culture that's sustainable and honors all of our people, then we want to move to be a culture that's based on respect. And those conversations are beginning. They absolutely are beginning, and I'm hoping that my voice can be a part of them.
So you said you've always been a poet. Did some of these poems, have they existed for a long time and you put them out in this book, or really was it from a flurry of writing?
It was a lava flow of writing. This stuff just poured out of me. The stories are familiar. I've been talking to, when I first started to visit high schools 20 years ago, I thought I was supposed to talk about literary elements and metaphors and things like that. But I quickly realized that the teenagers with whom I was talking needed me to be honest with them about my experience. Teenagers are hungry, and some of them are literally dying for responsible adult models of what a survivor looks like. I was a kid who was raped when I was 13 years old, and I didn't tell anybody for 23 years about that. When I finally did seek help and get support through therapy, my life turned around, and I became a much healthier person. I wasn't coping with my depression back then. I still had symptoms of PTSD. And when I talk to kids about that, and I talk about the choices that I made that led to being healthy, they're all ears, because so many of them are dealing with difficult situations, often with a violent tinge, bullying, harassment. I've talked to so many boys who refuse to use the bathrooms in their school because to use the bathroom makes them vulnerable, and they've already been hurt by other boys. So talking to them about how we can make our lives better, how we can be supportive for each other, and especially when it comes to issues of healthy sexuality, a lot of our kids are stumbling in the dark, and that's how they get hurt.
I've been hearing and reading a lot about that lately, that we think in this day and age where our children have been sexualized at a younger and younger age, that our children know all the answers. They don't know all the answers. They don't know any of the answers. They don't, and most of the answers they have are completely wrong.
You are totally right about that. It's interesting, on this book tour, I've been on the road for about a week now. I've had so painful conversations with mothers who come up to me in tears after my presentation. And these moms thought they did it right, bless them, you know, thinking about their relationship with their sons. And they talked to their sons about preventing pregnancy, and they talked to their sons about preventing sexually transmitted diseases. But they never talked to their sons about the notion of consent. They just assumed that their sons would never hurt a woman or a girl, that their sons would always ask before, you know, imposing their will in a sexually dominant way. And the truth is that so many of our boys are learning about sex from online pornography, many of them beginning at age 11. And in online pornography, what they often see are representations of non-consensual sex, women being hurt, women being bound, women being choked. And if their parents don't balance that with conversations about healthy sexuality, then we have a lot of boys who think that's what sex is supposed to look like.
You know, those first visits to schools where you were talking about Speak and your character Melinda, it sounded like the kids needed to know that there was part of you in that character of Melinda.
You know, I had a wonderful experience years ago in Arizona. This was very early in my career, speaking in high schools. And I used to allude in those early days to the fact that I had had a difficult time in high school and the fact that my family was in a difficult situation because my father wasn't doing well. And a young man asked me in the question period, "Miss, what was wrong with your dad?" And I finally told him the truth, and I said my father was a veteran from World War II. He had PTSD from what he saw there in concentration camps in Germany. And in order to cope with that, he was an alcoholic, and that caused a lot of problems for him and for our family. Rich, so many kids in that auditorium nodded their heads, and I don't think they even realized they were doing it. It was that kind of subconscious nod, because there were that many children in the room who were familiar with a family member who was dealing with substance abuse. And so when that boy then asked me, he was the most courageous boy I've ever run across. I really hope he's doing okay, because he helped me a lot. He said, "Miss, so why was your experience so hard?" And I realized that I had to speak up, and I explained that I had been raped at 13 and that I hadn't told anybody for 13 years. 23 years, in large part because I was afraid my father would hunt down the boy and shoot him. And just the overwhelming response I had from those students when I shared those facts of my life changed everything for me.
You tell the story, your family, I think perhaps for the first time, where you're not fictionalizing the story of your family in this collection.
Yes.
You tell the story of your father, his experiences coming home, of being in a rage, beating your mother horribly, and the distance between that family. I was really struck by some of your imagery. You really constantly referred to your family situation as in terms of meltdowns, shards, wildfire. Was that the feeling you had growing up for most?
When I was a child in elementary school, our life, looking back, was idyllic. My father was a college chaplain in the Northeast. My father was an extraordinary man, and be very clear, I adored and loved my parents, and I miss them terribly. But my father was struggling mightily, and sadly, there were no resources for him to get help. And so when his alcoholism took over, when I was in about sixth grade, and he lost his job, he was fired by the time I was in eighth, and he was unemployed for a while. We lost our home. Our mom had to hold everything together. And Daddy was suicidal, which terrified my sister. And there was nobody to talk to. We had moved so often, I didn't have friendships. I didn't have responsible adults around me who understood what was going on. And my parents worked very hard to hide all of this from our extended family. So it was like living inside a bubble of secrecy. And it was very clear that we did not talk about these things outside the house. So we just all sort of suffered in silence. I'm so fortunate that my parents lived as long as they did, my father in particular, because after I became an adult, he and I had 20 years where we didn't really talk that much. It was all very superficial and very rare. And finally, in the last decade of his life, when I was taking care of them, we moved them back north so they could be closer to us and we could keep an eye on things. Daddy and I started going out to the diner 3 times a week for breakfast. And that was when he began to open up about his war experience and about all those years that had been so challenging for our family. And we really were able to reconcile deeply with love and respect.
There's a number of really personal stories you tell in this new collection, Shout. My guest today is Laurie Haltz Anderson, a novelist, fine writer for young adults. And this new book is a memoir of free verse. And it's really a companion book to her 1999 highly acclaimed YA novel, Speak, in which she tells her own story as opposed to novelizing some of her own experiences. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You tell the story of your rape, one near encounter, in a three-part series of poems titled It, a story of a young man that molested you or pawed at you and tried to rape you, the young man who did. And the third part is the story of the aftermath. Very strange and very troubling, I think. It's titled Playing Chicken with the Devil.
Yeah. It's interesting. I had a conversation earlier today about toxic masculinity, and I think that ties to what we're talking about in terms of a culture that's based on dominance, which is so, so damaging to our boys and our men, as well as our women and girls and people who are identifying outside of those traditional binary modes. In our high school, there was a real hierarchy, a pecking order. A lot of it was socioeconomic. The men and boys whose parents were doctors or lawyers, and they would fly off to Colorado for vacations, and they could be the stars of the sports teams because they didn't have to have a job on a farm. They got to be they could afford braces. I remember thinking, gosh, that would be so cool to be that wealthy. You could afford braces. But there was this, what we call performative things. There were expectations about how boys becoming men should behave. And a lot of that centered around drinking. A lot of that centered around trying to steal as much, you know, sexual attention from girls as you could. You know, they would never call it raping or molesting. They would call it, well, maybe I went a little too far. But I know, you know, looking back on the boy who raped me, he was killed a few weeks later. He was very drunk on a dark country road. He and his brother were playing chicken. They would lay down in the road and roll out of the way before a car got there, or hope that the car would swerve around them, and the car didn't see him, so he wound up dying. And to feel like that's a smart thing to do at that age, looking back, you know, as an adult, I suspect that his life was pretty much a mess, which doesn't, for you know, doesn't excuse what he did to me, and I suspect he might have done it to other girls. But I think if we don't examine the expectations and the lives that our young men are leading, we will not be able to support them in a way and educate them in a way that will prevent this from going another generation.
I can't remember if there's a poem or it's an interview I read that you talked about. It says, you know, every time I speak to groups, which you do quite often, you'll see this one boy in the back. He's looking a little bored. He's looking, and he asks the question, what is, you know, he's expressing that toxic masculinity you're talking about.
And what I love about the question is that the question is an honest one. And the question I've heard from all over the country, from every single demographic in a high school you could imagine. And he says, what was the big deal? I mean, from his perspective, and he's very open about sharing it, which has always stunned me, the boys have said, look, sex doesn't take that long. It's not a big deal. Why would a girl be so upset? You know, in my first book, Speak,
wow.
The main character, Melinda, is, you know, a mess for 9 months until she begins, you know, through all of the school year, until she finally speaks up and reaches for help. Studies have shown that victims of sexual assault, 90% of them develop symptoms of PTSD within 2 weeks. 20 years later, up to half of those women and other victims can still be exhibiting symptoms of PTSD. 13% of victims of sexual assault attempt suicide. It is like going to war. Someone has declared war on your body. And it is compounded exponentially when the victim doesn't have any place to reach for support. Or if she does speak up, if she's not believed, if she has the misfortune of encountering police officers who, instead of having the rape kit tested, they just put it on a shelf. Did you know that there are 400,000 untested rape kits in America right now?
Yeah.
Right. So the failure of our culture to develop up until this point a healthy, loving, respectful, practical response to victims of sexual violence has led to not just trauma for the victims, but generational trauma. Because when a parent is in a lifelong struggle with PTSD or depression, that often affects that parent's children directly.
Earlier you were talking about how the symptoms manifest themselves within the first couple of weeks, and there are a number of poems that sort of reflect on your own time in those days. And I kept getting struck by this metaphor that kept showing up over and over again. It was concrete burns, which I didn't even know was a thing. there was several times I had to go to Google to figure
out. I'm married to a contractor who was a victim of concrete burns once.
And so concrete burns, I didn't know what concrete burns were a thing.
Yeah.
And so I learned this, and it's frightening and scary, the fact that you can wash concrete off, but it's the residue's still there, and it's still sucking moisture from your body.
It's eating at you. It'll eat your bones. When I at 13, I thought I knew everything, of course. So many 13-year-olds do, and I was afraid Daddy would hurt the boy, and I certainly didn't want to burden my parents with what had happened to me. They were dealing with so many other things, but obviously I was a mess, And I was coping. I think maybe I borrowed a page from my parents. My parents drank to cope with their own problems. I didn't want to drink, so I got high. Marijuana was really very easily purchased in my high school, and I wasted all of ninth grade being high. I forgot to go to class a lot. I didn't care about grades. You know, it just I was barely getting by, you know, minute to minute, I think, is the line from the poem. And it finally, you know, it was a wonderful gym teacher who saw a big, strapping girl and realized that I was kind of flushing my life down the toilet. And she encouraged me to go out for sports teams. And that changed my life. It probably saved my life. Because in order to be on sports teams, I had to go to my classes because I couldn't go to class. I had to do my homework. I had to maintain my grades at a certain level. Plus, being on a sports team, a swim team, and a track team, I was getting exercise, and exercise is a wonderful way to deal with depression. And I was beginning to make friends, and I had some structure to my life. And so becoming a student athlete is what was the beginning of my path to healing.
But you do write, it says, you know, the process of making friends after an event like this is so difficult. The shields are up at all times.
It's little bit hard, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah, I don't trust. Trust is a difficult thing for me to give freely. And I think that's maybe I think that's pretty common for people who have been hurt at a young age. You go on defense a little bit faster than people who have been blessed with a happy childhood and adolescence.
My guest today is Lori Holtz Anderson. Her latest book is a memoir of free verse titled Shout. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I found some of the strongest poems to be in this section after Shout came out, when you began speaking to kids and began hearing these countless stories of young people who've shared their own stories, males, females, transgender, electricians on a movie set coming up and saying, a big burly man saying, I'm Melinda.
Yeah.
Some of the strongest poems in this collection are from those particular days. I was struck by some about censorship. I was struck by something. For years you said, you know, when people tried to censor your books, which many people have tried over the years and some have, you used to be very angry and annoyed about that. And then you said in an interview, you said, eventually I understood. Nobody talked to them about sexuality. And so they were simply projecting their own sort of lack of frank talk about sexuality and boundaries, and they wanted to do the same to their children in sort of a way to protect children. And I was struck by some of the poems that sort of attack this idea of censorship, of trying to protect innocence. There's a one poem that has this great line at the end. It says, you know, everybody thinks the opposite of innocence is evil, and I think, or something like that. And you said, no, the opposite of innocence is strength.
When we censor the truth from our children as they enter adolescence, we make them vulnerable. We make the world a more dangerous place when we lack the courage to talk to them about the realities of life. And I do have a lot of sympathy for people whose reaction to books like mine is to try to censor them because they're afraid. And, you know, I raised a bunch of kids, and we have grandchildren now. And I understand that fear. It's a scary culture in which to try to raise children. But when you try to censor a book, what you're telling your children is that you, the parent, are unwilling or unable to have conversations about these things. Imagine if we decided to censor our children from information about driving a car. Right? But then one day, magically, they were handed the car keys and a license. And we would, of course, it would be an utter disaster. This is why we spend years annoying our kids with information about driving. You know, oh my gosh, my aunt would always talk to me about, you don't want to take a left-hand turn. And she would go on and on about left-hand turns, right? We give our kids so much information about driving because we understand the stakes. The stakes are high. You can die in an accident, whether it's your fault or somebody else's fault. We don't want our kids to die. And here's what we have to really deeply understand as a culture. We have been lied to. We've been lied to about who the sexually violent people are. And the lie is this. The lie is it's always the bad guy in the alley with a gun. And therefore, you know, we say to ourselves, well, I don't know any. I'm going on a date with a nice boy. He'll protect me if the bad guy comes out of the alley. If you are, for victims who are under 18 years old, 90% of them knew their attacker. 90%. Only 10% of those attacks of kids under age 18 were caused by a stranger. And yet we put so much energy into talking about stranger danger. I think most kids are pretty much aware of that. But that means we're failing to give them the information that will really save them. And at the same time, we have to do a much better job being open and honest with our boys about sexuality. And we have to start, well, you can start this with 2-year-olds because you start teaching 2-year-olds about consent, right? Consent is an easy thing to talk about. You don't touch somebody without their permission. You know, you see kids like tussling in the sandbox. Nope, he does not want you to put sand in his hair. You didn't, you know, and that's the early building blocks. So that when your children are getting to puberty, you're beginning to talk to them about healthy sexuality, then you add on to that that sexual consent has to be sober, informed, ongoing, and enthusiastic. You have to give consent, and you have to get consent, or else you shouldn't be touching anybody. And what I like to add to high school students and college students is that if the thought of having a conversation with your potential sexual partner about that, asking, do you want to do this, and how far are we willing to go, and how are we going to prevent pregnancy, that's like it's an adult conversation because sex is an adult thing. And if having the thought of having that conversation makes your stomach turn inside out with stress because you don't know how to have that conversation, I tell them that's fine. Your body is sending you a really smart message. Because if you can't talk about it to your partner before you do it, then you're just not ready to do it. Not a big deal. You've got 80 years to have sex. Don't worry.
Well, it is a strong collection, a powerful collection. What's been the reaction so far?
Oh, my goodness, Rich. I've been blown away, honestly. The reaction has really let me know that the time has come to be shouting about these things. We've got generations of mostly women, but again, there's a lot of victims everywhere who weren't listened to, who thought it was their fault, who have been carrying a lot of burdens for decades. And if we can allow them the space, we all can listen with love, there's a lot of healing that can happen. And that is the idea of people beginning to heal from those traumas is very exciting. And, you know, you can absolutely move on from trauma. You can... Those broken places can become stronger, and I just wish that everybody had the opportunity to be supported and to walk this path because life is so wonderful, and we all deserve to enjoy it.
The name of the collection is Shout. Lori, thanks very much for joining us.
I really appreciate it. It's good to talk to you again.
Young adult novelist Lori Hulse Anderson speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.